Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take to protect one of the most pristine marine habitats on the planet? And what can the project teach scientists about the resilience of our oceans? The first time Gregory S. Stone went diving off the Phoenix Islands in the South Pacific nation of Kiribati, the experience was a bit like traveling back in time to the time before human activity and pollution began to take their toll on the fish, corals, and aquatic plants of the world. But by his next visit, he and his colleagues could already see evidence of environmental degradation, which set in motion a broad-ranging effort to protect the region that would be supported by the UN, the scientific community, and residents of the giant but little known oceanic state. Gregory S. Stone is Executive Vice President and Chief Ocean Scientist of Conservation International, and he is President of Exploration and Conservation at the New England Aquarium. He's also editor, along with David Obura, of the new book Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. Greg, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be here.
Start, if you would, by telling us about that first trip to the Phoenix Islands, because by the time you went there, you had done dives all over the world.
I had. As a matter of fact, I remember when before I headed there, I had just finished an Antarctic diving trip where we were diving around this big iceberg and had to develop these special heating pads for our kidneys to keep our blood warm.
Wow.
And this was a much different place. It was on the equator, and it was an archipelago that had never been explored, never been surveyed before. So it was quite an amazing experience for me.
And the diversity of wildlife in that area is unbelievable. 500 kinds of fish, 120 corals, 44 birds. What makes the Phoenix Islands such a sanctuary?
Well, when I first went there and fell back into the water with my scuba gear on, I remember, my life changed. Suddenly I saw the diversity that you just described, and I realized what the oceans were supposed to be like. I realized what they had probably been like 1,000 years ago. But every other place I had dived in the tropics had already been overfished or degraded by human activity. And I had never experienced, and the scientific community for that matter, had never seen, what we call the baseline, what the oceans are supposed to be like. So the Phoenix Islands were kind of lost to time. They were remote. They never really had any permanent settlements. And as a result, they were kind of like a time capsule that showed us what the oceans were supposed to be like.
And part of the reason that they had never been inhabited was that not a lot of rain falls there.
Yeah, water, a couple things. Water had always been a very limiting factor. And, if you look at the Pacific Ocean, it's the largest ocean on the planet, okay? If you put the Atlantic and Indian Oceans together, they're still smaller than the Pacific. It's gigantic. And the Phoenix Islands are pretty much right in the center. If you draw a crosshair with the equator on the horizontal axis and the middle of the Pacific Ocean on the vertical axis, the Phoenix Islands are basically right there. Now, in ancient times, there were peoples in the Pacific, the Melanesians, the Polynesians, the Micronesians, and they all sailed around in these canoes, and they were able to actually traverse the whole Pacific Ocean. It's quite remarkable, like 1,000 years ago. And they did stop at these islands. As they were inhabiting and exploring places like Tahiti and Hawaii and Fiji. But they didn't stay, as you pointed out, because there was a lack of water. But also they were a little bit out of the way. They were sort of away from the proverbial bright lights of these bigger islands. So the ancient settlers never really used them. And then in modern days, They were never really settled either because they were so far out of the way and there was a lack of water.
Forgive me for asking a question that I know you've devoted your entire career to, but why is the health of the ocean so vital to even those of us in a landlocked place like North Texas?
Oh, Chris, no, that's a great question. And, I think the best way to think about it is if you can go back to that. Remember that image that we saw of the Earth when the Apollo astronauts finally got, up far away from the Earth and could look back at it and
yeah.
see this like globe hanging in the darkness of space. And Buckminster Fuller, I remember, coined the term spaceship Earth. And as you look at it, we are on a spaceship. You know, we're traveling 67,000 miles an hour around the sun, and we have no chance of resupply. Everything we've ever had, everything we ever will have is with us here. And guess what our biggest resource is? It's that blue part of the planet, the oceans. The oceans cover 70% of the globe, and they are the life support system of the Earth. They are like the lungs of our planet. They create most of the oxygen that we breathe, that you're breathing right now in your studio. They provide food, very important protein, for one out of every four people on the planet. They moderate our climate. They create the pressurized atmosphere that we enjoy. They provide a numerous number of benefits that make the Earth a nice place to live. Listen, if you want to see what the Earth would be like without an ocean, we've got plenty of examples in our solar system. All the other planets that don't have oceans are these hostile, horrible places, and that's why the oceans are important. That's why we have to take care of them.
And within the oceans, how do coral reefs function as ecosystems? And talk about also the kinds of activities and pollutants that can put that ecosystem at risk.
Well, coral reef ecosystems are based on an animal. It's coral. It looks like a rock. Corals are hard, usually. There are some soft corals. And they actually create the ecosystem. They create the structure around which all the other animals, including fish, invertebrates, and everything else that is on the reef, lives. You need a structure in order for there to be a place for things to live, and that's what the coral provides. Okay, so the coral's like a backdrop, and a lot of people think it's a rock, but it's actually a living organism that creates this structure. So without coral, you wouldn't have coral reef animals. You wouldn't even have some islands, the atolls. An atoll, like the Phoenix Islands, are atolls. They're very low-lying islands, and if you didn't have a coral reef around them, they'd go underwater because the coral reef keeps them above water. So they're very important. Now, in terms of threats, the major threat to coral reefs, turns out, is overfishing. If you take too many fish out of the water, the overall health of the coral reef ecosystem suffers. You need sharks, you need parrotfish, you need all these animals that sort of, they keep the coral reef system intact. So overfishing is the main thing. The other threats that harm coral reefs are coastal development. If you build a golf course right on the coast and you start to over-fertilize it with reactive nitrogen and phosphorus, these chemicals will flow into the ocean and degrade the coral reef system. So coastal development, overfishing are two big threats. And the last one I'd like to mention, which is a really big one, is climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And, as we're heating our planet through the burning of fossil fuels and the greenhouse effect, which I hope your listeners are familiar with, I won't go into the details, but it's heating the planet. And the oceans are the major heat sink on the planet, right? They're where most of the heat is actually stored. And the oceans are getting warmer. And as they get warmer, that heat actually kills the coral reefs.
And when the coral reefs go away, as you mentioned, there is, they help to keep these atolls from flooding. And in fact, there is also, simply from warming itself, the land area around the Phoenix Islands is threatened, right, by rising sea levels.
Yes, the sea levels all around the globe are rising today at rates faster than they've ever risen in the history of the Earth. And the reason they're rising is twofold. The major reason, and this is something most people don't realize, is something called thermal expansion, right? So when you heat a substance like water, it expands.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The volume of the water increases. And so if you heat the oceans by a degree or two, which is basically the way they're being heated today, that's enough heating to make them swell. And as they swell, they rise, the sea level rises. And that accounts for some 60% of the sea level rise today around. The rest of it is from melting glaciers, melting fresh water. This is water that's frozen and is on land. And as it melts and goes into the ocean, it, of course, makes the sea level rise. And this is what we saw with Hurricane Sandy. The storm surge came in on the east coast of the United States, high tide, and we have a higher sea level today than we've had in the last couple hundred years. That's why we had such massive flooding, is from this. Now, if you go to a remote part of the Pacific where you have an extremely low-lying island like the Phoenix Islands, this rising sea level is going to put them underwater probably in the next 50 to 100 years.
So you told us, Greg, at the top of the hour about your really astonishing first trip to the Phoenix Islands to dive there. How much time elapsed between your first trip and the next one, and what sort of change did you and your colleagues notice between those two trips?
Well, it was 2 years, Chris. After the first trip, I came back, and I was so astounded at what we'd found that I went around to my colleagues at National Geographic Society and others, and the National Geographic Society decided to help fund the next expedition, and I did a magazine story on it. And it was only 2 years later, but by the time we got back there, two things had happened. One was a fishing boat had come in, and a shark fishing boat, and had overfished the sharks on several of the islands. So when we fell into the water, it wasn't like the first time where I was surrounded by hundreds of sharks, which is, for a biologist like me, a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know
you may be the only one, but yes, I understand.
It may sound scary to people that aren't used to this sort of thing, but that's what you want to see, and by and large, sharks do not bother people.
Right,
so
right.
You want to see that. Now, the second thing we noticed, and this was even more alarming, was that the coral had begun to die from the heating of the ocean. There had been a warming patch in the central Pacific, again, caused by global warming, we believe, that had started to kill the coral. So here we were in one of the most remote places on the planet, this archipelago in the middle of the Pacific no one's ever heard of, and two things had happened. One is they'd begun to get overfished, and two, the effects of burning fossil fuels throughout the planet, you know, cars in New York City and in Beijing and factories and coal-fired plants had the effect of heating the ocean in the central Pacific. So it really shows you how small our planet is and how important it is to take care of it.
And how quickly the damage can set in.
Yes.
My guest is Gregory S. Stone. He's Executive Vice President and Chief Ocean Scientist of Conservation International and President of Exploration and Conservation at the New England Aquarium. He is editor, along with David Obura, of the new book Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. We will hear more of that story in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gregory S. Stone, Executive Vice President and Chief Ocean Scientist of Conservation International and editor, along with David Obura, of the new book Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. We have Bert on the line in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. I used to be a fairly frequent diver and snorkeling, mainly in the Cozumel and say, in the Caribbean. And, you know, I just became really shocked at the decline of the reefs and when I'd go back to the same place. And it was always blamed on the latest hurricane, you know, which I have to feel like these other things are really in the background, which prevents these reefs from being able to stand up to the hurricanes and recover. So if you could kind of comment on that, and then of course, the Great Barrier Reef, some studies say, is 50% wiped out or severely degraded. If you could just kind of comment on those things, and then if you could also talk about what's the latest on the acidification of the oceans in relation to global warming versus the damage caused by just the increase in temperature.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Bert. Those are great questions, and the way to answer your first question about the hurricane is to think about the oceans and a coral reef like it's the health of a person. Okay, now if you're a person and you've got several very serious diseases, and you know, I don't want to mention them because I'm sure some of your listeners have these diseases, but just imagine several serious diseases that are hard to treat, and then you're in a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chances of your survival are going to be diminished because your body can't handle all three of the diseases plus the car accident. Now, the car accident is like the hurricane, okay? Hurricanes are destructive to reefs, but if there's no other factors harming them, like global warming would be like one of the diseases, overfishing would be another disease, and the one you mentioned, acidification, could be a third, plus the hurricane, well, the reef just can't handle it and it dies. But if it only has one thing to deal with, either the hurricane, either the global warming, either the overfishing or the acidification, it tends to be resilient and can recover, just like a person, if they have one serious disease and it's treated properly, can recover. That's the way to think about it. And we're throwing multiple threats at the ocean these days and reefs, and they just can't handle it all at once. And then when you get a natural insult like a hurricane, it just throws it over the top. And that's what's happened in the Caribbean, places you've gone, especially in Jamaica, and other places. The hurricanes came in and devastated regions, especially on the north coast of Jamaica, and these reefs have not come back because of all these other insults. Now, to pull out your second comment about acidification, let me just explain how this works for some of the listeners. You know, as we burn fossil fuels, we're putting excess carbon dioxide, CO2, into the atmosphere. And you really want to think about CO2 as a pollutant, okay? We're polluting the atmosphere. It's a colorless, odorless gas, but it's a pollutant. And it heats up the planet through the greenhouse effect, but it also does something else. The oceans absorb lots of gas from the atmosphere. And with this extra CO2 in the atmosphere, the oceans are absorbing a lot more carbon dioxide. And as the carbon dioxide gets absorbed and goes into solution into the seawater, it forms carbonic acid. And it's creating, the oceans are getting more acidic. And it turns out that many animals in the ocean, including coral reefs, have, you know, calcium carbonate structures that dissolve when the oceans become more acidic. So this is another threat that is facing not just coral reefs, but almost every animal in the ocean, or I should say lots of the animals in the ocean, at some point in their lives have a calcium carbonate structure that's vital to their existence. And some of these calcium carbonate structures are beginning to dissolve in this higher acidic state of the ocean. We don't actually know what the outcome is going to be yet. This is something we've just sort of beginning to understand over the last couple of years. But you've hit on something very important, Bert, and we yet another thing we need to pay attention to.
Talk about this, Greg. How much of the damage to the world's great coral reefs, the best-known coral reefs, can be attributed to human beings loving them too much and wanting to be there and wanting to explore them and bringing boats and tourists and that sort of thing?
Well, the loving them too much, the being on boats and diving, there is some impact there. You know, when divers go in the water and they're not careful, they can kick with their flippers and kill some coral, or they can drop an anchor in the wrong place. And these certainly can have local, serious, long-term impacts. But those are minor compared to the other threats that I've been talking about. Probably the closest and most serious one about loving them to death is coastal development. Mm-hmm. You know, people want to come and be near coral reefs and look at them, so they build hotels, and guess where they build them? They build them as close as they can to the water. And people want to play golf and look out over the water. They build the golf courses right on the water. There's actually a term for this industry. It's called the sand industry because people like to, build things near nice sandy beaches. Well, very few of these developments take into account the fact that they're degrading the ocean nearby through their development, through what they put into the ocean and pollutants, through dust and sand and gravel that run out into the ocean and smother the reefs. That's another problem, is that runoff can smother reefs. So there is a way to do it right. You can build hotels. You can build coastal facilities that are what we call eco-friendly. They don't damage the reefs, yet they allow people to be near the reefs, and that's really what we need to do.
So, Greg, you and your colleagues recognized the imminent threat to the Phoenix Islands and that something ought to be done, and this was sort of a multi-step process over a number of years. But talk about the first communications with the government of Kiribati. Am I saying that right, by the way?
You're saying it. Yes, you are.
Okay.
You're saying it correctly. Yep.
Okay. It's not spelled like it sounds.
No, it's spelled like Kiribati, but it's pronounced Kiribati. Yeah.
Okay. So what happened when you contacted the government?
Well, the most people will recognize this area as the Gilbert Islands, which is one of the island groups in this nation. The Phoenix Islands is another group, and it's broadly known as Micronesia, so that just to give people a sense of where it is. Now, when I first went there, I didn't have any interests or aspirations to create or help create any kind of a conservation area, but I was so blown away by the beauty and the magic and the mystique of the reefs that I made the long journey to the capital of this nation, which is in Tarawa, a very famous World War II battle site, actually. And I presented, what we'd found. I felt like it was the right thing to do, is to out of a courtesy. And after my presentation, the ministers and the leaders in Tarawa that I showed it to said that I was the first scientist that had ever come back and told them what they'd done. This is the largest atoll nation in the world, okay? They control an ocean area about two-thirds the size of the continental United States. That's not their land area, but that's the ocean area that they control. So they're pretty important player when it comes to ocean affairs.
And yet the population is something like 65,000, is that right?
Yeah, a little over 100,000.
100,000, okay.
Very small population, very small landmass, but huge ocean area. So over the years, they'd had, a number of scientists come and do things in their ocean, and they had issued permits, like I had a permit to do it. But no one had ever bothered to go back and tell the government what they'd found. So that created some trust, and it created some relationships. And that's where it all began. I started going back and forth between the capital and then alternately traveling to these remote islands. And it became obvious to the nation that they wanted to protect this resource that they had. They didn't know they had such a pristine resource till we had brought them the information. So the credit really goes to the government of Kiribati, and especially the president, President Anote Tong, a real amazing leader, because they took the information that we had, and we provided guidance and advice, but it was really their commitment and their authority over these islands that created this, you know, the world's largest World Heritage Site, which is, you mentioned at the top of the hour, that the United Nations has gotten involved, and they've designated this area a World Heritage Site, which means that it's a site of importance for the whole world, largest and deepest World Heritage Site, and Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and many nations have helped and participated in this endeavor.
So one of the issues, Greg, that had to be dealt with for the people of Kiribati was the fact that there is, in fact, a fishing industry, and you mentioned shark fishing and overfishing, but interestingly, that fishing industry was not mostly controlled by Kiribati residents themselves.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and a central point to this story, Chris, is, you know, most of the tuna stocks, most of the last remaining healthy tuna stocks are actually in this part of the world within the waters of this nation and the surrounding nations. And the issue is that this country is a developing country, so they don't have a lot of resources, and the citizens can't go out and fish the fish themselves, the tuna themselves. So they issue access arrangements to foreign nations, including the United States, China, Japan, Korea, a whole bunch of nations. And these nations pay a very small fee. Usually it's 5% of the landed value of the tuna to go in and catch the tuna. And if any of your listeners have ever eaten chunk light tuna in the can at the store, they've probably eaten tuna from this part of the world because that's where most of it comes from. So when they closed this area down, there was a loss of revenue because they were excluding fishing boats and there would be a corresponding loss of fishing license revenues. So we came up with an arrangement where the Phoenix Islands Protected Area Trust was created and an endowment was created in order to pay the management costs of this protected area because the nation didn't have the resources to do that adequately, and then also to reimburse them for lost fishing license revenues. And that trust currently has $5 million committed to it. We need more. And all the proceeds from this book, by the way, go to that trust, so your listeners can buy the book and feel good about saving the ocean. But it's an innovative, a new, we call it a market-based mechanism, to save the oceans. So you're actually looking at the value of the resource in the marketplace, and then you're replacing that revenue to the nation through a conservation arrangement, a conservation trust.
Not so different from what's being done in other parts of the world to, say, preserve the rainforest.
Oh, you're totally right. Yeah, in fact, the model that we adopted for this was one from the rainforest, where Conservation International, my organization, had gone in and helped by logging rights to very important rainforest areas, and they didn't execute those logging rights. So they left the trees standing, but the local owners and farmers were able to still get revenue. And this is the future of conservation, is that we can't just lock things away and not think of the economic implications, especially for poor people. We need to make sure that nations and people that are relying on some income from natural resources still get that income.
We have an email here from David in Garland, who describes himself as a marine biologist stranded in Texas. David says a recent article in Science magazine by Christopher Paula discussing vast marine reserves pose vast challenges was rather harsh on the Phoenix Islands Reserve and critical of President Tong of Kiribati for not delivering the level of protection that was promised, citing that only 3% of the area is actually off limits to fishing. David asks, is Mr. Paula's assessment accurate, or is there more to the story. Any deeper insight or background on the Phoenix Reserve or challenges of implementing protection would be appreciated. I'm interested, he says, in lessons that could be applied to the new Chagos Marine Protected Area in the Indian Ocean.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm familiar with that article, and I know Chris, and his reporting is a little out of date. The history here is that when the Phoenix Islands Protected Area was first created, the nation closed down all the coral reef areas, what they considered to be the high-value areas. And that's the 3%. It's still an enormous area. It's some 25,000 square kilometers. It's huge. So they closed that down right away and then developed a management plan. We've developed the financing mechanisms. They developed the legislation, et cetera. And then this last year, the government instituted a new policy to close down the whole area. So all of the Phoenix Islands, there's policy in place to close down fishing throughout the islands. It'll take a little while to implement it in terms of, because of all these access agreements, they're on different timelines, but the policy is to close it down, and it's being totally closed down now.
How is all that enforced, given the small population of the area?
How do you enforce it?
Yeah.
The enforcement for this area relies on cooperation and collaboration with other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And one example of this is the something called the Shipwrighter Agreement, which Kiribati has with the United States. And this is an agreement where the United States sends Coast Guard cutters down to the region and takes on local police officers from Kiribati, and the police officers have the arrest authority, and the Coast Guard boat has the right of approach on the high seas. So not on the high seas, but within the waters of these nations.
Right.
So this has resulted in the arrest of vessels and very severe fines. So Kiribati is relying on that. They also have similar arrangements with the help of aerial surveillance from France, New Zealand, and Australia.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Gregory S. Stone, editor of the new book Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Gregory S. Stone. He is president of exploration and conservation at the New England Aquarium. He's executive vice president and chief ocean scientist of Conservation International. And he's the editor of the new book, along with David Obura, of Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. If you would like to be part of this conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We are speaking, as I said, with Gregory S. Stone, who is with Conservation International. And Greg, do we have you back on the line with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Talk a little bit about this. What does it mean to have a designation as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and what does it take to get that designation?
Well, it's... what it means is that the United Nations, through one of their arms, has said that this is an area of global significance, global importance. And there's two kinds. There's cultural world heritage sites, and there's natural world heritage sites. And this is a natural world heritage site, which means that the natural features of this area are of global significance. Now, how do you get it? It's a very long process. The government of Kiribati had to compile a very comprehensive dossier, a sort of a application like the size of a phone book, detailing the area's values, the the species that are there, the management plan, et cetera. That's then reviewed by a number of scientists and policymakers, and then there's a deliberation, and it's decided. It takes years.
And there have been brand new species discovered there that have not been documented anywhere else on the planet?
Yes. Yeah, well, the ocean is such a wonderful environment and such a vast environment that when you go to these remote areas, one of the exciting things for a marine biologist like me is that you find new species, ones that have never been found before. So we found several new species of fish, about a half a dozen, and a couple of new species of coral, and that's just one of the real high points of scientific exploration.
We should say for people that are hearing about the book and are interested, it is full of photographs. In fact, you could almost call it equally a book of text and a book of photography, some of which, I guess, were done by Paul Nicklin of National Geographic. Is that right?
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul Nicklin of National Geographic, also Brian Scarry of National Geographic. He has photographs to the cover picture. And, it's richly illustrated with the marine life there, and also the people that have been involved, and lots of little tidbits, including the whole thing about the possibility that Amelia Earhart crashed there, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, you actually had, you yourself found evidence that might have suggested that that theory is correct.
Yeah, I was walking along the inner part of one of the lagoons on one of the Phoenix Islands called Nicomororo. There's eight Phoenix Islands in Kiribati, and I saw this wheel rim grown into the coral, and I didn't really understand the significance when I saw it, but when I got back, I reported it and caused quite a stir with some archaeologists that were looking for her, and they went back trying to find this wheel rim, thinking that it might be from her Electra. They didn't find it in the end because the shifting sands and the storms had covered it up. But it was my little brush with a possible history there of Amelia.
It's like the one that got away for you.
The one that got away, yeah. To this day, I'm regretful that I didn't take a good picture of it or do a little more exploration around it. But when you're on an expedition like that, you see a lot of things happen, and I just didn't understand the significance of that particular thing.
Why is the aquatic life around coral reefs so incredibly colorful?
Why is it so colorful?
I mean, there are other parts of the ocean, am I right, where the marine life is not quite as spectacular to look at?
Yeah, well, part of it is that the water around coral reefs is generally pretty clear because you're in the tropics and you're near the surface, and there's lots of sunlight. So, I mean, marine life in general has a lot of color, but coral reefs, you tend to see it more. There's also a lot going on because there's so many different species. You know, you get male fish have different colorations that are attractive to female fish and vice versa. And you've got coloration patterns that have evolved for avoiding prey, and all animal life has such wonderful variety. It just so happens in a coral reef, there's a lot of it packed in there, and the water's clear.
You have also, given your advocacy of the region, gotten to know the people and the culture of Kiribati quite well. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like for humans to live there?
Well, the people of Kiribati are just amazing group of individuals. They, you know, their culture, Chris, is, you know, some 2,000 years old. They've been there a very long time. They've got incredible understanding of the ocean, of the weather patterns, and they've lived on these small islands all these years. They have really impressive navigation abilities, and they are the warmest, happiest, most sincere people I think I've ever met. It's been one of the great privileges of my work on this project is to get to know the people of Kiribati.
And what's especially striking about that is based on their geographic isolation, it's not like a lot of foreigners are there very often.
No, they've... the nation is really hard to get to. I mean, the Phoenix Islands themselves, if you want to go there, it's you got first of all you got to charter a boat, and it's a 4 or 5 day boat journey from Fiji. And if you want to go to Tarawa, where the political capital is, you can fly there, but there's like one or two flights a week, and when you get there, you've got to stay for almost a week. So there aren't a lot of foreigners there. There's no tourism to speak of there. It's kind of a very interesting place to travel to if you're kind of an adventure traveler.
So when you go, do you camp? How do you get by when you're doing science explorations as opposed to political work?
Well, the science exploration, all of it is boat vessel based or boat based. So we need a stout, sturdy, ocean going vessel that can, you know, get across 4 or 5 days of ocean passage, and we live on the boat. So our days are pretty much spent. You get up in the morning before the sun rises. You eat breakfast and you start diving. And we spend we dive 4 or 5 times a day, and you have to live on the boat. That's where your food is. That's where your water is. We do land on the Phoenix Islands and do surveys of the birds and the turtle nesting sites, et cetera. But every night you're back on the boat. There's no other place to stay.
Is that sort of work, that aspect of your job, what keeps you going and, you know, through all the staff meetings and office sorts of things that you now are required to do?
Well, you know, I think all marine biologists and all natural history scientists, we all share a passion for the natural world. And yes, it keeps you going, you know, knowing that when you're in those meetings and you're traveling, you know, on the airplanes all the time, that those periods where you're actually underwater, in the ocean, swimming with turtles or sharks or triggerfish or whatever it is, it really brings you back to your passion and to your subject matter. The reason that, you know, I do the work that I do is for the sake of these animals and also for the benefits that they provide humanity. You know, without nature, you know, humanity and our existence on this planet would not be possible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Nicole in McKinney. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I traveled there about 10 years ago to visit a friend who was working for the Peace Corps. And while there, I did an informal tour of some of the reefs and was struck by the number of World War II wrecks and the war debris that was still there. And I was wondering, I'm not sure if it's still there today or if anything's being done to protect and preserve those historical remains.
Nicole, I assume you're talking about going to Tarawa and that part of the Gilbert Islands?
Yes.
Yeah. There's two things I'll say about that. One is that they are still there, and there's certainly a historical component to that. And it's hard to save things underwater because they tend to want to rust away, especially those steel ships that are on the lagoon floor and on the seafloor. So there isn't really any efforts to protect them or save them. They're there, and you know people go and look at them. But one of the problems that's emerging there and throughout the Pacific is that all these ships that went down and airplanes and whatnot during World War II are now beginning to leach out pollution. Mm-hmm. Either the fuel that was on the boat is leaching out into the ocean, or asbestos, or munitions. And it's an issue for the Pacific Island nations because, you know, if it was, generally speaking, it was Japanese and American conflicts. And if an American military venture sunk a Japanese ship, you know, who's responsible for cleaning it up? Is it the responsibility of the nation that owned the ship, or is it the responsibility of the nation that sunk the ship, or is it the responsibility of the nation that has the wreckage there? And there's no resolution to those questions, but these ships are all rusting away now, and after the last 60 years or so, all the pollution is starting to come into the ocean.
And I guess there's no way to go down there and sort of only remove what's toxic.
Well, there is, and there is some interest actually in going and recovering some of the fuel oils now that oil is so valuable. But it's expensive and it's difficult, and so it's hard. And then when it gets to munitions and asbestos and other pollutions, that's really difficult. But there is some incentive to go down and get the fuel oils.
So talk a little bit about, Greg, for people who are interested in the work that you do, beyond buying the book, what are good ways for people to sort of stay up to date on what's going on with ocean conservation?
Well, a couple of ways to stay up to date. There's a website called the oceanhealthindex.org, and that website describes ocean health. It's a project that I was involved with and Conservation International was involved with to create the first international scientific metric for measuring ocean health globally. So you can go there. It's an amazing website because you can dive in literally, or not literally, but metaphorically, you can dive into the website and learn about all the threats that are facing the ocean. You can also learn about what is being done to remediate those threats and what you can do as a listener to remediate those threats. So I'd recommend going to the oceanhealthindex.org. You can also go to conservation.org, our website, and we've got very rich marine information there that's linked over to Ocean Health Index.
Do you imagine that the success that you and your colleagues have had in creating the Phoenix Islands Protected Area will serve as a model for other places on the planet?
Well, it already has, Chris. There's a group of nations. They're called the Pacific Island Forum, and it's 15 nations in the South Pacific that have, they all get together, the leaders get together once a year and go into retreat. And it's kind of like the G20 of the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all the nations down there, including Kiribati, Australia, New Zealand, and they get together and form common agendas. And a few years ago, they got together and said that they wanted to begin to manage all their ocean area together and to create a network of marine protected areas throughout the region. And this is an area that covers 8% of the planet's surface or 10% of the oceans. And they used the Phoenix Islands Protected Area as the model. So after that awareness of that declaration, they call it the Oceanscape. So it's this big, vast area of an oceanscape. The Cook Islands put their commitment in to make a big marine park. New Caledonia made their commitment for a new marine park, Tokelau, etc. So Phoenix Islands really was catalytic in the region in creating, it's almost like a domino effect, you know, where other nations said, hey, they're doing it, we want to do it too.
And the new book, I have to jump in, I'm sorry. The new book edited by Gregory S. Stone is Underwater Eden, Saving the Last Coral Wilderness on Earth. Greg, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. We welcome your comments and questions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.